The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I think the relevance of legacy for any age group is that you define your trajectory every day. And over the span of your life, you aggregate those small pieces together. And it's the little time frames that are so important in terms of the decisions you make. So whether you're older in years and more mature and don't have a lot of time left in front of you, or you're a young man or a young woman and you have a lot of time, the point is your decisions matter.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, it's really fun to read the intelligent comments that come in on the YouTube channel, Dave. And some of the sarcasm. Gary asked this week, he goes, would you explain, quote, yield with regard to bonds? And we've been talking about negative yields.
And I had a similar encounter with my son this week as he opened his bank statement. And granted, I mean, at 13, he doesn't have a very large bank account. But he looks and he says, 67 cents?
Yeah.
Really? And I just couldn't believe that having any money at all in the bank, and I mean, 67 cents was an insult. And I reminded him that he could live in many Scandinavian countries and the 67 cents could have gone the other way. For the privilege of having money there at the bank, it could have cost him 67 cents.
You know, it's hard to get your head around negative interest rates. And we've been trying, but I was thinking about it. It's like double negatives. When you say, I never, never do that, you've all of a sudden shifted it. But negative interest rates, you really can't figure out how that makes sense. It's never, 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 never. You're basically paying somebody to go out and risk and use your money. It's insane.
Well, the consequence of negative rates is that you have many things that used to be commercial, which are no longer really viable from a commercial standpoint. You look at the average Japanese bank today, and the cost to manage and run those banks is 100 basis points, and yet they're receiving less than 64 basis points in income. They're not viable commercial entities.
It's a slow bleed.
We were reading an anecdote from Jim Grant's most recent letter, and he mentions a gentleman who's receiving a $38 check for having borrowed money from the bank in Denmark. And the issue is, how does a bank do that? Make money on a loan? The whole notion of borrowing short and lending long, when in fact, you know, the model has been shifted to what exactly, I don't know, but I don't think that these are commercially viable offerings.
You know, there's a tension though, Dave, because we know that the markets are very similar to gravity. You may look like you're defying gravity for a while, but you're not going to defy it for forever. And I think of our trip to Argentina a few years ago when Kirchner was in power. And the inflation rate at the time was about 40%. Now, of course, it's increased since then. But what we're seeing in Argentina right now is a reversal, and rates are skyrocketing because the risk is skyrocketing.
Last week, the peso ended down 1.8%, and that was pretty much in line with other emerging market currencies. And they were all those currencies were suffering from a bit of risk off in the marketplace. They were moving in line with junk bonds, notably weak last week. And safe havens were very popular last week. Gold was bought aggressively. We started last week in the low 1400s. Monday got started with a almost $30 move, and it put in a peak this week of $1,535. Again,
right.
That's $1,535 per ounce. For those who haven't been watching the price of gold recently, it's actually been on the move. The Swiss bond market hit negative 100 basis points. So along with the yen, the Swissies, the treasuries, the bunds in Germany, they were all attracting safe haven buying.
You've got a flight to safety going on right now.
Yeah, and back to Argentina, you've got Mauricio Macri has, over the last 4 years, implemented reforms which move Argentina back towards a realistic and, frankly, a sustainable economic model.
Sort of the only hope for Argentina, actually.
I think so, because after years of the Kirchner's sort of dynastic corruption and handouts for all, Macri brought a more business-minded approach, certainly more business-minded than his predecessor.
Well, and he's introducing something we all hate in our own lives, but we sometimes have to utilize, and that's what they call austerity. If you're spending more money than you're bringing in, you have to introduce austerity to the family.
You mean living on a budget requires discipline? Yeah. You might question his skills if you are feeling the impact of the current 50% inflation rate, or if you've had some of the subsidies which he's cut, you know, negatively impact you. Those are subsidy cuts which may look and feel like targeted austerity. But truly, I think it's his free market orientation, which is the only thing standing between Argentina and a fiscal abyss.
Well, the sad thing, though, is the voters would really like to return to the days where things were free.
Well, that's right. And so over the weekend, you had the Argentines vote in a primary election, which puts Alberto Fernandez in the running to replace Mauricio Macri. And guess who his vice president will be?
Isn't it amazing? She shows up again like a bad penny.
Cristina Kirchner, there again. 47.7% for the leftist challenger, 32% for the incumbent Mauricio Macri. And that's taken as kind of a signal that they know where the October elections will go. So, yeah, we know exactly what the populist crowd in Buenos Aires thinks and what they want in October, because they turned out in a landslide to vote
for Kirchner. Yeah, but the markets are speaking. The markets are speaking. And, you know, we can look back and we can go, oh, yeah, free stuff really makes a lot of sense. But the free markets, it scared them.
Isn't that an interesting contrast between free stuff and the free markets? Because that is the Kirchner model, free stuff, hand out subsidies, and frankly, either a comparable or worse inflation trajectory. Because remember, it was her husband and it was her, they have overseen two of the great collapses of the Argentine economy. And this is within the last 20 years. But yeah, what do the markets think? The Merval, which is the equity index in Argentina, closed Friday at 44,355. It opens Monday at 29,138. That's a 34% drop on Monday. And in U.S. dollar terms, factoring in the drop in the currency as well, you're down 48% in U.S. dollar terms. That's using the official exchange rate. That exceeds, that 48% down day exceeds the one-day decline of 45% in the year 2000, also in Argentina. And this week's volatility in the Argentine stock market ranks it as the second worst single-day decline in financial market history. It's only outdone by Sri Lanka in 1989, 61.7% in a single day.
Doesn't it go to show you how quickly things can change? I mean, just a couple of months ago, we had Steve Hanke on, and he was liking Argentina if they were going to continue doing the things that they were doing. But look at, you know, we were talking about negative interest rates. Negative interest rates only work as long as the system is holding together. At this point, the Argentinians are having to pay substantially higher rates for people to give them money.
I hope Steve is nimble, because this was a tough 24, 48, 72-hour period.
Hopefully he didn't bet too hard, yeah.
All the difference a day makes. Yeah, yeah. The Argentine five-year credit default swap, so this is an indication of potential default on debt. It's what it costs to insure debt. It went from 1,132 basis points to 2,136 overnight.
Almost doubled. Almost doubled.
Up over 1,000, that signals a 75% probability of default over a five-year period.
Wow.
And again, what's the difference between Friday and Monday? Be careful how you spend your weekends, particularly in the summer, because some things happen while you're disengaged and on vacation, which could be very, very important.
Well, let's say that you liked Argentina and you had purchased a 30-year bond on Friday. Okay. And you knew that you were locking in for 30 years, 9.52%. Now that's a good percentage, but look at the difference between Friday and Monday.
Yeah. For those who are interested in income, what a great place to go. Except you wake up Monday and it's yielding 12.2%, an increase of 2.68%. It's a big deal. You know, so when you're talking about the price of the bond, not just the yield moving higher.
Right, the principal value of the bond just collapsed.
22% drop.
Yeah.
And again, that's not factoring in translation into the currency. The Argentine peso was down 18.68% in a day, down 30% at its worst point during the day in terms of volatile trading, 30% in a day.
Yeah.
Can you kind of feel it as if, I mean,
this is bond. This isn't stocks. This is not high risk penny stocks. What we're talking about are supposedly the most stable investments in the world.
You said this is bond. I thought you were going to say
James.
Bond.
Well, okay.
No, it's Argentine bond.
This is bond. How about we talk about 100-year bond? Oh. Shaken, not stirred.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know.
Do you remember the 100-year bond?
If it's not shaken and it's not stirred. It just got wrecked. The 2017 issued, if you recall, we talked about this on our commentary. It was oversubscribed. I don't remember if it was two or three times oversubscribed.
Everybody wanted the 100-year bond from Argentina.
Last week, it traded as low as 74 cents on the dollar. And this week at 54 cents on the dollar.
Yeah. Lesson? It's going to keep dropping.
Lesson, hey, anyone? Yeah, yeah. I mean, so this is, I think, what you conclude. Can you predict, let alone imagine, what takes place over the next 100 years?
Right.
And in this case, the government bonds of 2017, they may not survive even 2 years, let alone the 100 that they're supposed to go the distance. So reflect on the oversubscription. Just pause and think about that. Reflect on the oversubscription.
Yeah, there was a line to buy them.
Go back to the archive. We were utterly confused, as you and I discussed it, as to how the all-knowing and all-wise Mr. Market could pile into 100-year paper in Argentina,
right,
and treat it as a normal and routine bet. Pension funds, insurance companies saying, we'll just lock in the long-term cash flow. Political stability in the Pampas is as reliable as the weather.
Well, we've talked about Europe as well, though. Okay, you've got people who are buying Spanish and Italian and you name it, horrible bonds that actually are yielding less than U.S. treasuries. That's amazing.
I know, but this is the same absurdity when you think, okay, so a year ago, Italian debt was yielding 3.6%. Today, right, the 10-year treasury in Italy is 1.4%. I mean, in the Italian debt is yielding less than the U.S. Treasury. This is a world of insanity. And to assume that Mr. Market is going to get it right, again, to quote from a book that Grant wrote years ago, Mr. Market miscalculates.
Well, and I hate to say this, because the volatility really hurts the person who trusted the lack of volatility. But it's always refreshing to me to feel the market and the market repricing things correctly.
Well, I mean, as recently as July, you're right, we spoke to Steve Hanke on the taming of hyperinflations using, right, a currency board. That's a unique concept. It's one that he's popularized. He's used in Bulgaria. He's used in many Eastern European countries. He was very bullish on Argentine debt. Oops. Oops.
Ouch. Ouch.
The board has not been adopted in Argentina, which is essentially using a stronger currency as your own, mm-hmm, adopting it as your own, and adopting the interest rate regimen from that more stable currency. So that's something that is an option, certainly. And I don't think it's likely under the new elected officials if that is what happens.
But if Macri could have done it, it would have been a great play.
Or if by some miracle he does, then maybe Argentine debt is the best bet on the planet today as he puts a floor under the currency and a cap on interest rates. But, I mean, think about this. If Macri introduced a board, he could stabilize the currency. And, you know, we had 20% devaluation, nearly 20% devaluation this week. This week, on top of the already registered 50% annual inflation.
Right.
And this is where I don't think Macri has a chance in October, at least with the information we have today, because the 20% devaluation on top of the 50%, this is going to work its way into the consumer's life between now and the election. And the more inflation pain that's experienced, that equals more political gain for Fernandez and Kirchner. You've got the leftist populism on the return, and it doesn't matter that history could teach us something. It doesn't matter that it's a failed system which brought us the multiple currency crises earlier in this millennia and this century with,
yeah,
Argentina.
And forget that it was actually Kirchner who brought this in. What's actually occurring right now is still a carryover from what they did during the Kirchner regime. It reminds me of what we talked about last week. We talked about term limits being a good thing, but terms probably needing to be a little bit longer. Because even in this country, okay, if something happens during the first 4 years, a lot of times it's because of what was built up before, and the person doesn't have long enough to distance himself or change. Macri has not had enough time to change or add the currency boards or what it would take to keep Kirchner from coming back.
You have such deep structural impairments within that economic and political system that fixing it does take some time. And frankly, do you know where it's most difficult to fix things? I mean, this is going to sound I'll say seven Hail Marys and maybe walk on broken glass for saying this, but this is the weakness of democracy. Mm-hmm. You can't get things done in a quick fashion because there is order and process which has to be respected. Let me just say on top of that, I would take the disorderly and slow, inefficient democracy any day.
Well, that's what Churchill said.
Alternative.
That's what Churchill said. But tyranny of the urgent requires a tyrant for the urgent.
Yeah.
You know, an urgent tyrant can solve things. Look at China. Look at what's going on right now in Hong Kong.
And that's exactly right. You see Xi Jinping and he makes himself a lifelong leader.
Yeah.
And there is no more elections. It means that he can get stuff done.
Did you see the trucks rolling in? Did you see that happening?
Well, I mean, tough weekend. You've got the airport, which is overrun. And so the Hong Kong airport is shut down. And, you know, we talked about this last week and in weeks previous, but as the PLA was mounting their forces in Shenzhen, I've been through Shenzhen. I've been on that highway that connects Shenzhen into Hong Kong. And listen, I mean, this is a big deal. We said there wasn't going to be a tank man in Hong Kong. We may be corrected within less than a week's time.
And you've got Chinese PLA people who are dressing up as demonstrators coming in and actually causing some of the violence. This is a replay of what we've seen at least since 1918 with Russia.
Yeah, sometimes revolutions, as they occur, are helped along. They're not as spontaneous as they would seem.
Well, you know, we've talked about the rise of populist rumblings, though. The populist, whatever form it takes, okay, populism is really making an impact. And as we see what's going on in Argentina, we're starting to get a little bit of a vision of other emerging markets and the populism that's taking over there.
You know, it was 2016 that I spoke at an economics conference in South Africa, and the topic that I chose was populism and the impact of populism. We talked about the five-star movement. We talked about a number of emergent trends in Europe. And there is a difference between left populism and right populism. But in the emerging markets, this is where there's clearly greater sensitivity to populist rumblings, not because the effects are of a different character according to geography. You can't say, well, populism is different because it's here versus there. But you've got the populist promises like those of the Fernandez-Kirchner duo. I just don't see they're hardly any different from the U.S. appeal to modern monetary theory.
Sure.
There's no difference. It's just in the emerging markets, there's less liquidity in the emerging markets. So when the financial participants begin to look at the consequences of your free lunch and who actually pays for it, there's far greater volatility. Volatility is exaggerated in geographies where there's less liquidity. Does that make sense?
So, sure. Well, you've always said liquidity is the major, it shows up in every financial crisis, lack of liquidity.
Yeah, if we had the equivalent of a Kirchner-Fernandez duo being, you know, winning a primary here in the United States, I think you could see 10 or 20% downside, not necessarily in a day. There would be a negative impact to the U.S. equities markets and the U.S. dollar and the U.S. bond markets. But again, it's a deeper pool of capital. It's far more liquid. And the impact, I think, would be less exaggerated because of that increased liquidity here in the U.S. But I think what I'm trying to say is that markets are telling you there is a cost and there is a consequence. And you may call it free and you may assign it as a gift to some beneficiary in society, but it actually does come at a cost. And the financial markets do that math pretty quick.
Well, it just goes to show a long-term lack of volatility can turn immediately into instant volatility.
As I look at our stateside Democratic primaries, you know, this is not so much a comment on Argentina, but just a reminder that we have a wide selection in the Democratic primaries that offer as much hope for the capital markets as do Fernandez and Kirchner. A hope of a different sort, I suppose. But politics, as it turns out, does matter. For the average investor, certainly for the average investor as they open a portfolio statement. And this month is going to be pretty interesting for those in Argentina. And no, economists don't have models. They don't have models that predict or explain political volatility or the kind of economic and financial market collapse that we have in Argentina.
Well, and if this collapse continues, am I remembering this right? Didn't the IMF give Argentina the largest bailout in history? Wasn't it like $50 billion?
Yeah, Macri organized this according to a certain set of disciplines and rules that would be implemented for the Argentines. And so, you know, it raises some good questions. What will the IMF do with a new administration? and the likelihood of that new administration being willing to follow through on Macri's commitments is slim to none. So do you really have a year 50, I think it was $55 billion lined up, or does that disappear? And how does that impact the financial markets further? Another thing is, what does the long-term investor of Argentine debt think today? I mean, again, this is just 2 years ago, 100-year paper seemed reasonable. And I'm guessing that those last two days have probably felt like 100 years.
It just goes to show you that people will run to safe havens, and sometimes they look at bonds in various countries as a safe haven, a little bit like gold. But in the end, it's gold. I mean, how many times have people gone into Argentine paper and then later said, gosh, I wish I would have just bought gold?
We watched 1400 with an eagle eye to see that it not only got above that level, technically 1385, but psychologically 1400. And getting above that level, staying above that level, very constructive in terms of the long-term trajectory for the gold market. But I think, you know, here we've had some short-term activity, which have driven safe haven demand, you know, well above 1500 in about a week. So, you know, yes, gold acting as a safe haven, you get the equity markets, an experience of return to volatility, you get the bond markets. They continue to herald sad tidings, at least for those who need an income. It's right. Really not on offer. And in that case, gold becomes more popular because as the opportunity cost to owning gold, it keeps on going down and down and down. What would you say if the central bank community was making a long-term commitment to lower rates?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we're talking about much lower rates. In Europe, you have the memory of bail-ins, which if you're an investor in Europe and you're saying, I want to have cash, I want to have liquidity, you're really discouraged from having significant bank deposits because you know there is the real potential of a bail-in. It's already been communicated. It's already
been
enacted.
The IMF paper talks about it.
And then you push those risk-averse investors into the arms of the governments who are issuing debt and paying nothing on it because they don't want to be in the banking system. But a part of the weakness within Europe today is an inability to attract money into the banking system. Think about, as we talked about last week, the circulation of money through an economy. $1 deposited is lent out, redeposited, lent out, mm-hmm. and $1 may have a $10 footprint, or €1, a 10 euro footprint. But if you're not willing to put money into the bank to be lent out because you're concerned about bail-ins, you do find yourself clustered into safe haven buying and into bonds. And so, no, there is an intractable disinflationary trend in Europe, in part because low rates and the history of 2008, 2009, I forget what year it was it 2010 or 11 where they actually had the bail-in?
Right.
And that memory leaves a residue which has not been forgotten.
And we talked at that time that bail-in may be a model that would be used on a wider scale. And I know we keep bringing this paper up, the IMF working paper on how to handle the next crisis. That 83-page white paper that really you only need to read the first page, and I'd recommend page 40, it basically tells you they're going to have to capture people in the system and then start charging them deeply negative rates to get through this next one.
It's what academics call financial repression.
Yeah.
And it has a fancy name, but a not so fancy impact to your pocketbook. But back onto the safe haven aspects of gold, you also look at the emerging markets, and there is this concentrated curse of exposure to China. It works really well for you on the upside.
But if you're a little country below China or below America, it's very impactful.
Yeah, because of your trade relationship with China, most of your emerging markets have a strong dynamic relationship with China. As goes China, so goes the growth trajectory of most of what they used to call the LDCs, the lesser developed countries. Mm. Then you've got the equity markets here in the U.S., right? So this is all pointing to why gold's gotten to 1500, why it's likely to correct, frankly, from here and give you a decent entry point, I would guess, in the next 30 days.
Well, look at the price on stocks. Okay, just take the equities market, Dave. Back in the year 2000, back in 1987, the year 2000, year 2008, we had PEs that were well above 20. Right now, we've got PEs well above 30.
Well, and so back to the long-term reason why I think gold would make sense. The U.S. equity markets are ripe for reversal to the mm-hmm. downside. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Crestmont PE, if you look at the cyclically adjusted PE popularized by Robert Shiller, sometimes called the PE 10 because it takes a 10-year moving average for the PE, you look at the Q ratio, the replacement value of the real assets of a company, they're all edging towards the 2000 level, the 2000 peak levels.
That was the tech stock bubble.
This is the highest level that we've seen in all of financial market history. So today we have overvaluation in equities, and it's the highest, second highest in financial market history. And that's very relevant to the gold market because investor demand for metals is inversely proportional to interest in stocks.
Right.
So to the degree that people are buying stocks, they're not buying gold. To the degree that they're selling stocks, they are buying gold.
Even though the central bankers have been buying gold worldwide, you can't give gold away to an American investor right now.
No, so investors operate on a different bandwidth and wavelength. Should we go through an extended corrective phase in equities, we're going to go through an extended growth phase for the metals. So, I mean, we've had some nice short-term moves in here, and maybe some of that's consolidated. But I think the longer-term story is, again, daily, if you're looking at the charts, it's overbought. But if you look at the weekly and monthly charts, they're turning positive, mm-hmm. and they're confirming the view that regardless of the 10 days or 20 days or shorter time frame where you could have some downside volatility, the metals have several good quarters.
Okay, but you've got a guest that we love. Okay, you have to listen really carefully because he's got a very, very strong Scottish brogue. But Napier thinks it's going to be much longer than several years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, he's saying that we could be entering a 30-year bull phase for gold. What that really means, if you're looking at it not in terms of the price action of gold, but the implications in the other currency and capital markets, is that capital and currency are going to have some rough times ahead. It reminds me of the recent weeks where, you know, on their wealth management team, we have an outside technical analyst come in, and on Wednesdays, we look at a variety of charts, and this is one of the conclusions, is we've been waiting for confirmation of a longer-term bull market trend. That confirmation in the gold market is here. It is now, and I think we're looking at years of growth ahead of us.
Okay, so I've got 32 years in the game here with the McIlvaney family, and gold has, it's gone up and down, but I mean, it's gone from $300 to about $1,500 in my career here. The last 6 years, 7 years, I have to admit, have been pretty doggone boring in the gold market, as they've got this thing, it looked like they had this thing settled and manipulated. If you're talking a 30-year bull market in gold, Dave, I'm 56 years old, okay? And that would mean that I get to actively continue to watch gold rise until I'm about 86 years old. Now, can we continue to meet back at our table, back at table 30 at Ken and Sue's restaurant on Main Street in downtown Durango for the next 30 years? Can we do that?
I certainly hope so. We need to put in a plea with Ken and Sue to keep the place open another 30 years.
That's
and
one of my favorite things. We meet at table 30 at the back of the restaurant at 4:30 in the afternoon before the restaurant opens. And we talk about the things that ultimately show up on this program.
You know, one of the things that I think is worth recalling is that less than a year ago, we were getting calls and reports, and even some of our best friends were saying, the fix is in. Stocks will only ever go up, and
gold will only
ever
go down
because right. The central banks have figured out how to control it. Will you just stop and remember this 90-day window where we've gone from 1,200 and change to 1,500 and change, and put in your brain that no, the markets are not controlled. They can be influenced for a time, but ultimately not controlled. And when the free markets speak, it is with power and dynamism that no central banker has the imagination nor the power to control.
Right.
And so that's the reality. But you're right, table 30. Table 30, it's what happens when you decide to sit and talk about a variety of topics every week for 11 years.
Right.
And, you know, when you try to count the hours, Kevin, how many hours have we sat there and discussed?
Well, and not just talked, but it's usually after many, many more hours of reading privately.
I thought you were going to say many, many more Taliskers, but I you're right. No.
You're giving the secret away.
Thank you. There is a secret sauce.
Yeah.
And it is a sauce.
That's true.
How many hours of reading and preparation? My guess is that it's an average of 15 to 20 a week. And so here we are in our second decade of commentaries. We didn't call them podcasts 11 years ago.
Right.
I don't think. We're still a few years away from episode 1000. Granted, that'll come at the end of our second decade. But when we reach the end of our second decade, you know, what's funny is I think we're going to be in very, very good company. I have so much respect for my colleague, Doug Noland. And I'm an amateur athlete. I have a lot of internally motivated drive. And I look at the weekly regimen required to be ready for game time.
Right.
And I know that the hard work occurs when no one's looking. And there's a lot of quiet hours. The quiet hours are preparatory for the raucous ones, the mm-hmm. crazy ones. You've got thousands of hours of hard work and preparation, and that translates into success in a span of time that is, on a relative basis, small.
You know.
And that's when performance matters most.
I was thinking about that because when you challenged us to do that half Ironman in Hawaii, and honestly, the very thought of it scared me. But when I look back, the race was fine. But actually, it was the hundreds of hours of training that I enjoyed the most, because I can look back and I can say, wow, probably it's a 100-to-1 ratio. I figure if you're going to train for a half Ironman, you're going to put about 500 hours of training in for a 5-hour race. So I'm guessing, and it might be more than that, but I'm thinking it's about a 100-to-1 ratio, preparation versus performance.
Well, the markets are similar. You're ready and you're engaged in a thoughtful process, or you're not, and you're caught flat-footed and underprepared. And as we at present put in one of the biggest stops in financial market history, and as we move through a period of incredible monetary and fiscal ingenuity, and it really is.
That's a euphemism, Dave, ingenuity. Yeah, there you go.
Well, I mean, there are a few people in the financial markets that are as aware or as prepared to navigate those waters as my colleague, Doug Noland. Mm-hmm. He manages the tactical short program on our wealth management platform, and he also contributes daily as a market strategist for our other model portfolios.
That just blows my mind that he's actually part of the team. This was a guy that was influencing the team before, as we read Credit Bubble Bulletin for years.
And again, this goes back to the things that you do often and repeat and on a systematic or routine basis. I love what we do meeting there at Table 30 every week for the last 11 years. Doug has passed. He's passed the 1,000 mark. He's written the Credit Bubble Bulletin. This year, Doug passed the 1,000 mark, writing for over 20 years and chronicling a period of historically unprecedented credit expansion. His weekly commentary is on history's greatest credit bubble. And I mean, it's an amazing resource. I still pinch myself. I wake up in the morning and I look at the collection of news articles, which he's already put on the page. And I think he's just saved me an hour.
Right.
Because I could find them reading through the Financial Times and the Economist and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and Barron's, and they're already collated. They're already in one place. And so, I mean, it's with hours. How many hours involved? I mean, it's reaching into the tens of thousands for him. And I can reasonably say, without exaggeration, that I know of no equal in terms of the process of analysis and articulation in the credit and financial markets. This is what fascinates me. And I think what is a key takeaway for any of us, weekly disciplines in aggregate make a profound contribution.
Well, and I just want to insert something here too. The Credit Bubble Bulletin would be something that people would pay hundreds, maybe even several thousand dollars a year for. It's free if our listeners just go to McIlvaneyWealthM.com. You can just read it every week for free.
Yeah, he's done this for years. I think this is one of the reasons why philosophically we're fairly compatible, very compatible. My dad used to say, and still does, give it away and it comes back to you.
Yep.
And he's been educating with a passion to inform and teach and elucidate and remove the obfuscations of bad ideas within the financial markets. And he's been doing it because he had to. He's been on a rescue mission.
You know, and we all need to be on a rescue mission. I think of the book that you wrote, Legacy, Dave, that, you know, you go back and you are pulling distinct lessons from your life out and your family's life and trying to create an idea of legacy. But that's a harder thing to communicate. It's like integrity. You can lose it in an instant, but it takes a lifetime sometimes to build.
I woke up earlier this week to the sound of my phone ringing at 6:30 a.m. and there's a live radio interview for a discussion on the intentional legacy.
So that's your new alarm sound, which is, hey, we're live.
We're live. Are you ready? And I told my wife, I said, I think I exaggerate my tone or something. I'm like, yep, I'm ready to go. and internally, I'm like, oh my goodness, I haven't even had a cup of coffee. Well, I think I was better at bouncing out of bed without that cup of coffee a decade ago.
Mm.
I've had that happen before with news outlets reaching out to discuss the gold markets or the oil markets or other financial topics. This one hurt. And in part, it's because it's accessing not just sort of facts and figures or ideas that are about the world out there.
This is deeply personal.
It is. And it's the world in here. And to discover that at 6:30 in the morning without a cup of coffee in a meaningful way, to communicate that in an intelligible way, can be challenging. But the questions on the show, I mean, of course, they're different than a Bloomberg or CNBC because legacy is the heart of the questions and the point of the conversation. And I would say this is where I take it a different direction. Legacy is the aggregate of the choices. It's the sum of our values and priorities expressed in all that we say yes to or what we say no to in our daily lives. Mm-hmm. So again, it's just basically the aggregate of your choices, right? That was the topic. It's not a balance sheet, not merely a balance sheet. It's not merely a worth statement in dollars, net of liabilities. And that may be a small result, a benefit from the choices made by yourself or by others. But the conversation on legacy, as I frame it, is one of curatorial work. We orchestrate and we set in motion a variety of personal and cultural markers. These are your reference points, the things that have most value to you. These cultural markers, they can be, again, among friends and colleagues or with family. And what they are is the routines and the rhythms and the habits which define your life. And we contribute to the ethos with not only what we do, but how we do it. And we end up defining what I describe in the books as the delights and the deeds and the disciplines of our life. These are the things that we choose as an individual or as a family to put in motion. And that ends up spilling over into the lives of the people that we share life with.
Well, and we talk about that 100-to-1 ratio for training. Okay, let's say you do train 500 or 1,000 hours for 5 or 10 hours of racing. Deliberate action for preparation for those times, that deliberate action a lot of times is in the quiet times when no one's looking.
Well, that's right. And I look at the volatility this week, and Kevin, I'm reminded of when we started the commentary in 2008. It was like drinking out of a fire hose. Right. There were so many things happening on a daily basis. There was no way on a weekly program to keep up with all of the important facts and figures as we're launching directly into what is now known as the global financial crisis. And I think we're heading back into that phase, but I think this is also where you get to see the best results of the deliberate actions which have been taking place in those quiet hours. Mm-hmm. When we start counting the quiet hours, the hours of practice, the hours of conversation, which you and I have shared in the commentary, the hours of listening, the hours of action and reaction, which you see as a narrative. And I mean, I guess you have to take the third person to see it that way. But if you take the third person, you got that perspective. There's a narrative, and we have to ask, is it what we hoped it would be? I think the relevance of legacy for any age group is that you define your trajectory every day. You define your trajectory every week, every month, every year. The decades are made up of these smaller time slices, and over the span of your life, you aggregate those small pieces together, and it's the little time frames that are so important in terms of the decisions you make. So whether you're older in years and more mature and don't have a lot of time left in front of you, or you're a young man or a young woman and you have a lot of time, the point is your decisions matter.
Something that Jim Grant said when you were interviewing him about the Bagehot book. Bagehot in the 1850s said, "I just wish people would do less." Now, he was a very deliberate thinker, but I think about as I grow older, Dave, I find that my quiet hours of preparation, I really prefer to become longer and longer, more deliberate, and my actions become shorter and more deliberate. Maybe not taking action all the time. That sometimes can foul a person up. The wisest people often look like they're doing nothing for a period of time, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, wow. Where did that come from?
Right. You actually can see that quiet period in the life of Churchill where he does nothing for a long period of time. And then there is a moment where there's no one who's better prepared for battle.
It was his greatest hour when Hitler finally threatened England.
And he really wasn't a man made for peace. He was a man made for war. Mm. Maybe that's even more true of the general who's always longing for peace, but is the only person really prepared for war. If you haven't, sit and reflect on where you are and where you're going. That is what Churchill's notion was when he said, the farther back you look, the farther forward you can see. And I believe that it's true of individuals as well as nations. We need to remember, we need to reflect, and we need to reset our trajectory if necessary. There was a good friend of mine who, and a good friend of my father's too. I got to spend some time with this person last week, and this relationship goes back over 40 years. And he said to me out of frustration that he had no legacy to leave. Tax laws shifted in the 1980s. John McCain lied to him to his face about how he would vote on a particular issue. It cost him tens of millions of dollars. Cost this gentleman tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, but that doesn't take the legacy away.
Well, and that was my point. It's not true that he doesn't have a legacy. He's one of the most loyal friends I've ever known. I watch him as he relates to others, and he is a champion of their causes. He is a selfless promoter of their successes. He is a coach. He is a mentor. He is a friend that has chosen loyalty and commitment. And in a thousand ways, he leaves a richer legacy than King Midas. And I think about where we're at historically, and I think to myself, there are people who will lose great fortunes in the years ahead and make great fortunes in the years ahead. As a perspective piece, I think it's important to remember that that doesn't really matter.
You know, I think about your friend talking about that, and hopefully, and I bet you he doesn't think this all the time, just the loss of money is the loss of legacy. But I can hear humility in his voice as well. This is a man who had many millions of dollars, had built many things. He made millions and he lost millions. It's like what Jim Deeds talks about. He said the first guy who was going to hire him said, how many times have you been bankrupt? I never hire anybody who hasn't been bankrupt at least twice. Okay. So that comes, but I think of humility with Doug Noland. You were talking about Doug Noland. He would be embarrassed to hear us talking about his credit bubble bulletin the way we do, but he has garnered respect without demanding respect.
No, I agree. It would embarrass him, and he would not sort of bring attention to himself, but I want to honor him for all the hard work and effort put into becoming the man he is. You remember Malcolm Gladwell. He points to the proficiency and the professionalism born out of 10,000 hours of work on anything, whether it's piano or painting or anything in between. What is it when you've doubled that number and it's not 10,000, but it's 20,000 or 30,000 or 40,000 hours? You and I know pilots that have put in that kind of time in the seat, and Doug is similar. I marvel at the perfect team, which I think we come pretty close to today. And it's rarely planned. In my experience, it's not because of a genius in terms of hiring practice, but we've had events converge. We've had people converge. We've had ideas converge. We've had through that opportunities emerge. And then we have our responses, which have defined a course, praxis, action in Latin. We still have to choose. And no, we don't want to overchoose, as you say. Too much action can be detrimental.
Well, and I think you mentioned perfect team, but a perfect team is one that realizes their imperfections.
Well, right. So perfect maybe is the wrong word, but we have a phenomenal team in our precious metals brokerage business, now passing its 47th year. A phenomenal team in our wealth management business in its 11th year. Our newest offering, Vaulted, the digital and savings and banking alternative we launched a year ago. It is a rich existence to be surrounded by great people with great skills and a relentless drive to make the most of the time we have together doing the tasks that we have in front of us, knowing that every choice matters and is a part of the legacy created and we ultimately give to others. And that to me is almost in a sense overwhelming. And I wish for all our listeners that if that's not your experience, that you consider how your choices align with making that your experience.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.